This is another episode of the Decoding Purpose podcast. My name is Rebecca Tapp, and in every episode of Decoding Purpose, we speak to humans of both influence and impact to explore how life's turning points help us to decode purpose and to ignite a more meaningful and purpose-driven life. Welcome to another episode of the Decoding Purpose podcast. For those of us here in Australia, the jacaranda flowers are in bloom, the sun is shining, and with talks of possible vaccinations and borders opening here in Australia, there is a sense that maybe this new normal is starting to feel, well, a little more normal. That said, the new part is undeniably a wave whose wake is yet to crash. This has been a year of change like no other, and the ripple from that change will be felt for many years to come. One thing that has been established in 2020 is the fact that this virus has leveled out all of humankind. A virus that did not distinguish between rich or poor, black or white, male or female. In addition to that, in our pursuit to find a vaccine, the world has collaborated more so than ever before. After all, when it comes to solving problems, collaboration trumps genius, and diversity by design is a new world superpower. Diversity in people, but also the diversity of humankind and technology. For all of these reasons and more, today I wanted to talk to a woman who is an influential advocate for diversity, inclusion, and the future. Her name is Lillian Kikuvi, and Lillian has a core focus on decoding the intersection between diversity and the role it plays in propelling individuals and organisations into a future that supercharges the power of inclusivity. To give you a little bit of background info, Lillian is a Kenyan-born Australian with a rich cross-cultural experience in Australia spanning over two decades. She has discovered significant barriers and opportunities in Australia in the area of diversity, equality, equity, and inclusion. As a result, she is deeply passionate about flipping the narrative that diversity is not only an ethical or social decision, but an economic one. As a speaker and an independent corporate consultant on diversity in the workplace, Lillian has a focus on bridging the gap between the role of organisational diversity today and the possibilities for what it could look like tomorrow. She takes what she calls an intersectional approach to diversity, which we will talk more about in the podcast, and she challenges what is considered diverse is not always obvious, and more often than not, diversity is hidden or yet to emerge. I can't wait to dive into that. So without further delay, get ready to dive into a conversation built upon a foundation of research, yet translates in a way that questions the status quo and really asks us in many ways to get comfortable with the uncomfortable in creating a new space for richer conversations about diversity and inclusion, both in Australia and around the world. Welcome to the podcast, Lillian. Welcome to the Decoding Purpose podcast. Lillian Kikuvi, it is such a pleasure to have you with me today.
Thank you very much for having me. Now, before we start the interview, I thought I would start paying my respects to the owners of this land. I am connecting with you today from Melbourne, and I'm on the land of the Wurundjeri people, land which was never ceded. And I'd like to acknowledge any Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders that are listening to this podcast today. And I want to pay my respect to their past, present, and emerging leaders. It is an absolute pleasure to be on this land and to learn from one of the oldest continuous cultures on this planet.
What a beautiful way to start the podcast. Thank you so much for that beautiful acknowledgement.
You're welcome.
So, Lillian, In kicking off the podcast, given we are here today to talk about purpose, I'm curious to understand how 2020, which has been a year like no other, particularly for you down in Melbourne, how has this year influenced your connection to purpose?
2020 is a year like no other. You're so right. That statement is so true. And for me, this year has deepened my connection to my purpose. At the beginning of this year, I didn't know that I was entering into a year of a recession, a global pandemic, a year of shattering economies, or dealing with forced isolation and then forced lockdowns, spiking domestic violence. That I had no idea at the beginning of this year that 2020 was going to be this year, this kind of year. And then when I thought things could not get any worse, the Australia Institute Centre for Future Work reported that the pandemic will compound inequality. So what this means is that people who already are disadvantaged and marginalised will experience even further regression. So we're talking about groups like the Indigenous population, people with disability, culturally diverse individuals, the LGBTQI community. There's going to be further regression for these groups. And this is concerning on a personal level. Just the thought of experiencing even more inequality is very scary. And there's also systematic racism that has taken center stage this year. This has been amplified by the Black Lives Matter movement and Aboriginal Lives Matter movement. The national protests that we've seen around Australia has shown that a lot more people are now questioning the whole entire premise of white supremacy and dominance. The community is now placing greater demands on leaders and organizations and individuals to step up and end systematic racism. So the question is, how do organizations and leaders support their people in an era of multiple crisis? Well, Harvard Business Review talks about organizations ramping up their diversity and inclusion efforts. And they strongly encourage businesses to work closely with practitioners or diversity and inclusion practitioners to fully understand the current context, to understand the unique impact that it has on its people, and to create a strategy that is fit for purpose, and most importantly, looks after the most vital asset for a business, which is its employees. So this multiple crisis that 2020 has presented has created a sense of urgency in diversity and inclusion. And this has propelled me to adapt my business model and move all my services online, to diversify my service offering, to get into new alliances and partnerships and create new programs. And my intention for all of these activities is to provide better support and better solutions to help my clients to navigate through this challenging season, but also to thrive at the same time, if that is possible. So my purpose has deepened because of what we're experiencing today.
And I mean, just on a deeply personal level, how has that felt for you? Like at a visceral level, given the context of what's happening, you know, what has been happening in Melbourne, and you guys have been in lockdown, you know, for months now, you've only just come out. Like, how has that felt? How has that sense of purpose felt to you?
It's felt like unrest. It's this sense of unrest. It's complacency for me is no longer an option. When I'm having a difficult day and I'm struggling on a personal level because of, you know, I've experienced stage four restrictions and I'm feeling sorry for myself. So for me, it's felt like unrest, and I just feel like I need to continue doing work. I don't want to stop because there's a lot to do.
And it's such important work that you do. So I guess this is a good segue to the next part of the conversation, because the work that you do is, you know, solely in the space of diversity and inclusion. So can you kick off today's interview clarifying exactly what we mean when we're talking about diversity and inclusion?
Well, I'll start with the definition of diversity. And there are many definitions out there. The one that I go to is offered by Diversity Council Australia. And they define diversity as all the differences between people in how they identify in relation to two areas. So there's a social identity aspect. So that's to do with age, caring responsibilities, gender, sexual orientation, or social economic backgrounds. That's one part to the definition. And the other part is professional identity. So this includes things like education, work experience, and organizational role. So these differences influence how someone perceives themselves and how they're perceived by others. But there's more to diversity than meets the eye. And the iceberg, the image of the iceberg is commonly used to drive this point home. Now, if you think about an iceberg, there's the section above the water level and there's a massive piece that is underneath the water level. So the piece above the water, the waterline represents the noticeable features. So when I look at you, Bex, the noticeable features are your gender, your age, and your race. But then there's a larger part underneath the iceberg that represents the invisible characteristics like your values, your skills, your religious beliefs, your religion, or your spirituality. Now, the message here with this particular iceberg model is to actually remind people that it is quite difficult to judge the size and the shape of an iceberg. So just as it is that difficult, then it's also quite hard to ascertain all of an individual's diversity traits by simply looking at them. So this challenges us to go beyond that traditional approach of focusing on the physical, focusing on the visible, and placing equal importance to the visible and invisible traits that make up the diversity traits of an individual. And when we shift our mindset and when we start looking at diversity from that point of view, then we're able to better realize and appreciate that we all are diverse individuals. That mature way of looking at things allows us to approach each other with that appreciation. So that is a definition of diversity. Inclusion, on the other hand, has very different definitions. Deloitte offers a great definition that looks at four areas that are discrete yet interrelated. So the first part of inclusion is being treated equitably and with respect. The second part is about feeling valued and belonging. And the third part is about feeling safe to speak up without any fear of retaliation or embarrassment. And the fourth is about feeling empowered to grow and do one's best work. So it's really important to have that clarity around what inclusion is and how it's defined, because this helps organizations and individuals to hold each other accountable and also allows them to measure for inclusion. But there's a big issue that I have seen over the years doing this work. One of the biggest mistakes that businesses make is that they focus only on diversity. So they focus on representation, just the numbers. So while adding women in leadership or promoting people with disability or opening your doors to people that are culturally and linguistically diverse is great, it doesn't necessarily change the culture of an organization. It doesn't necessarily make these groups of people feel included. And I've worked with organizations that have just focused on that aspect, and it's just more, it's almost like a tokenistic approach. Just tick a box. We've got the numbers, we've opened the doors, we've had the people here. Look at us, we're doing really well. But there's another level, which is now inquiring what the experience is like for these people when they're in your organization. And the organizations that just focus on ticking a box end up having tension across staff members. There's a sense of frustration and disappointment. So for organizations to really unlock the benefits of diversity and inclusion, they need to focus on inclusion as well. And that is where the work is. Get the people in, open the door, but also focus on how they feel, how their experience in the workplace. And that is what inclusion is all about. So that's a main point that I really want to make, that diversity and inclusion go hand in hand. They're not separate things. If you want to maximize on the benefits, you need to actually look at them together. There's a quote that I mentioned, I think I've shared this with you a number of times, that just captures the essence of diversity and inclusion. It's from Vernon Myers, and it says, diversity is like being invited to the party. Inclusion is when you're asked to dance.
Beautiful, beautiful quote. Look, I find it, it's an interesting conversation because on one hand, when I think about diversity and inclusion, if we go back to reflecting on tribal consciousness, which I know you actually talk a lot about, tribe principles in your work in the diversity and inclusion space, there is this natural celebration of everyone as unique individuals who have a gift or something to offer the collective. And that is also something that's very important to inclusivity and the formation of tribe, that as individuals we have our gift, but the gift ultimately is about serving each other and serving the tribe, which seems quite different to a corporate organization where you're sat within this success paradigm, I'm going to call it, where, you know, you're aiming for the next promotion and you're aiming to be the best and you're aiming for the next pay rise and all of that sort of thing, that there's kind of a bit of a tension between those two ideologies. How have you experienced that?
That's a great question. For me, that's a massive conflict for me, coming from a culture that is collectivist. And you talked about that sense of tribe. And one of the concepts, one of the principles that I talk about in my presentations is harambe. And this is a word from my native language, Swahili, that means pulling together to achieve a common goal. So what this means for us within Kenyan tribes is you know, we place greater value on what is good for the whole community or the society or the collective over what is good for one person. So that collectivist mindset requires everyone to step up and be an active player to advance the collective good, the collective agenda, basically. That's what I mean, the collective agenda. And it is so powerful because it's about you showing up with what you have. It's not about waiting for the stars to align. It's literally show up with what you have, with your time, with your money, with your love, with your intellect. Just show up with what you have and contribute to the collective agenda. And this has allowed tribe members to feel a sense of confidence that they'll be looked after and the tribal needs will also be looked after. Now, I've seen aspects of that collectivist mindset in the workplace. I've seen organizations that do it really well. They are able to mobilize collaboration, teamwork. Those are things that are represented in their values, their corporate values, and their values are actually lived by their staff members. So I've seen that, and I've also had the pleasure of working for those organizations. But then I've also worked for organizations that it's all about individualistic agendas. It's about me. And that has been the biggest challenge. I think when I look at the roles that I've done and where I've been the most unhappy, it's generally been about values being in conflict. And in those situations, the organizations that do actually recognize that there's some individuals that are driven by their own personal agenda, but then they also have values that are quite inclusive, they would leverage something called social accountability. And this is something that I heard recently from University of Melbourne, where you tap into the need for someone to look good. Tap into their individual agenda. How can you get that person to contribute to the collective, but tap into their individual agenda? That is social accountability.
Which I think is, in essence, our nature. That if we go back to the tribe, that stepping into our potential is also where we dovetail into our purpose. So in being our best, we are also in service of the tribe.
Exactly. But what the difference is now, the intention that you set out, like your initial intention. So the tribe, the initial intention is about advancing the collective agenda. Mm. But then when you're dealing with other people who have a different agenda, it's about them pushing their own agenda or maybe looking good. Then that the intention that they start out with is different. That's a difference between our tribal, the collectivist mindset and the individualistic mindset. At the end of the day, for me, this is what I say. At the end of the day is, what is the goal? What will be achieved? If we're going to achieve a more diverse and inclusive workforce, and somebody has chosen to use their individualistic agenda to get there, but it benefits the collective, I don't have a problem with that. If you're going to start from that collectivist mindset and your agenda is, okay, everything that I do here is going to benefit the tribe, I don't mind that. At the end of the day, the question is, what is the outcome and who is being impacted and who is benefiting and who is being excluded? Those are my questions.
Mm. So Lillian, I mean, you've referenced quite a bit from your upbringing. In Africa, can you talk to me about how the African spirit has influenced who you are today and has informed your purpose?
Mm. African spirit is everything. It has shaped my purpose. I grew up in Kenya and I spent the first 20 years growing around such a powerful and rich culture and traditional culture as well. I also had a lot of modern influences, but my family were very intentional about us maintaining our traditions. And what that meant for me was I understood my tribe, I understood the customary law, I understood who I was within the tribe, I understood the role of the elders, who are the custodians of traditions and who are the leaders of the tribe. I understood the power of storytelling and how information and lessons and laws are passed down from generation to generation through this platform. I understood things like the importance of language, so the tribal dialect as well as national dialect, and the importance of language when it comes to inclusion. I understood the inclusive infrastructure that exists within the tribe that allows tribe members to feel like they belong and have a strong sense of relationship capital. So all of that influence shaped my upbringing for 20 years. And that is why I choose to share my ancestors' wisdom and show people how to apply that into modern thinking, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's about leadership, whether it's about advancing diversity and inclusion. I bring my cultural heritage and I ensure that it is central in everything that I do in driving change, because I have seen how holistic it is and also the power of inclusivity within the tribe. And I want to be able to share that knowledge and to help people as well gain cross-cultural knowledge that will allow them to be better human beings, better together, to be able to create a world that we are all proud of, a world where diversity and inclusion is not even a topic, it's a normality. So that is how the African spirit influences everything that I do in my workplace, my personal life, and pretty much everything in everything that I do.
Mm. You just used the phrasing that diversity and inclusivity is normal. And if we look at that, we have come a long way. We are living in an era of multiculturalism, of globalization and cultural convergence. And, I think we've seen progress in gender and sexuality and inclusivity for people living with a disability as well. That said, there's obviously still a lot of work to do for it to be normal. So what is your take on where we're at with regards to inclusivity becoming normal? How far away are we from that point?
Look, we're definitely making efforts to be more inclusive. And we are seeing this with the rise of social movements like Me Too and Black Lives Matter and Aboriginal Lives Matter movements. And this is actually showing that people care, that people are so socially conscious and are willing to mobilize and to collaborate to drive inclusion. We also have legislation pertaining to human rights, gender equality, modern slavery. And these are just a few examples that actually show that there's some systems and structures that are designed to drive inclusion. Mm-hmm. But we can do a lot better. We can do a lot better. There's so many areas for improvement. Now, if you just look at gender as a way of as an example, women continue to be underrepresented in leadership positions, and you see that across many businesses, across different industries. There was a study that was done by Australia's leading employment and workplace expert, and his name is Conrad Leveris, and he published a report last year in May after looking at Australian Bureau of Statistics data and public disclosures made in annual reports and websites. And what he found was that there are more CEOs in the ASX 200 companies with the names Andrew and Michael than there are female CEOs. So this actually just highlights how there's a glaring gap, and this is just gender. When you look at cultural diversity, these the same numbers when it comes to women and leadership, culturally diverse women are grossly underrepresented in top leadership positions. There's one study that found that for every 100 ASX directors, there are only two culturally diverse women. And for me, growing up and navigating Australia and navigating my corporate career without women in leadership that had shared experiences, for me, I just felt like I was flying blind for most of my career. I didn't have anyone to show me what was possible. I didn't have anyone to provide me with a blueprint on how to get into a leadership position, being a culturally diverse woman. Mm-hmm. And this has made my career even harder. And that's culturally diverse. That's cultural diversity.
Do you when you look at touching in there on some of the issue, though, that yes, it's about society and what's considered to be the norm, but that maybe some of this is also around the stories we tell ourselves as women or as people who are culturally diverse, that there's some narrative that we believe we're not good enough to step into those roles.
There's definitely a place for that. I know that for a long time, especially in the initial years of being in Australia, my narrative was, I'm not good enough. But yeah. And that was mainly influenced by the experience of racial discrimination. The system that I moved into, I believe played a big part in that narrative, in creating that narrative and in perpetuating. Exactly, that's right. And when you look at also gender in general, whether it's also for cultural diversity, just gender in general, that is women are trying to break that ceiling, but there's so many systems that work against them to actually get to those top leadership positions. And that's why you hear of statistics that are staggering. There's one that was released by the World Economic Forum earlier this year, and they say that it's going to take 99 years for gender equality to be realized across the world. 99 years, and the pay gap is horrendous. It's over 50% across the world. So you can have the best narrative, you can have the best personal narrative, but if the system it works against you, then it's quite hard to progress. So we just have to recognize this is what we're dealing with. And that is why I'm doing the work that I do, because it's about contributing to changing the systematic barriers that exist for women, changing the systematic barriers that exist for culturally diverse individuals and other disadvantaged groups out there.
So I have to ask you, I mean, season two of the podcast has had a focus on turning points, and the reason for that is whether it's by choice, often via a crisis, they act as catalysts for purpose. And I've seen that time and time again. And, you know, in hearing you talk today, I can just hear the passion that you have and the fire you have about the work that you do. Was there any particular moment in time where you were like, I've got to stand up and do something about this? This is my dharma.
There are two catalysts that that come to mind for me. The first one was my move to Australia. I moved here to study. I came here in 1999 and I went to the University of Wollongong, which is in the southern part of New South Wales, to pursue my university, my undergrad and postgrad in psychology. And when I arrived in Australia, my experience of humanity drastically changed. Because I went from being part of the majority group all my life in Kenya to being in the minority group. And this transition gave me amazing opportunities with regards to expanding my cultural intelligence, with regards to building incredible connections with amazing people, that includes you, Bex, and also maturing my worldview. But at the same time, it's been incredibly challenging because of the experience of overt racism and microaggression. And this is my everyday reality. And this has been the case since I arrived in Australia. Now, for me, the experience of racial discrimination is when I experienced it the first time when I came here, it was a surreal experience, because prior to that, in Kenya, I had learnt about racial discrimination and white supremacy through my studies and also from stories from my family members who lived through the oppressive regime of British colonization. I had learned about the apartheid system in South Africa. I'd learned about the history of slavery. So I had known of racial discrimination, oppression, white supremacy, dominance from an intellectual level until I came to this country and experienced racism and truly, truly appreciated what intergenerational trauma is. And the initial years were tough, were so tough, because I was ill prepared and I had to survive. I was on my own. My whole family was back overseas and I had to find ways to make sure that I had my head above water. And I chose to have masks. I had masks in my, what I call my survival toolkit. And one of the masks that I used to go to was actually not speaking up on the issue of racial bias and discrimination. Even though as a young girl in Kenya, I always had a heart for social justice. I was vocal. In fact, I recently discovered that my parents used to call me the human rights activist of the family because of how vocal I was. But then when I came here in the initial years, I could not find my voice. I chose to mask my voice for a very long time. But then these masks stopped serving me. 10 years of carrying this heavy mask, or masks actually. When I experienced a breakdown in my health, my relationships, that for me was a catalyst for change. And when I made that decision to change, I decided that I want to use my voice. I want to use whatever I have, my qualifications, my expertise, my intellect, my networks, everything that I have to change the status quo for those who are disadvantaged and marginalized like myself, and to make sure that they do not go through what I've gone through. That was the first catalyst for me, my own personal crisis. The second catalyst was the training that I took through the Speakers Institute. Now, I started that journey in 2017 and I signed up for the very first program because I wanted to master communication, because I wanted to be more influential in my role, which was a senior manager at Medibank at that time. And that's where I met you, Bex. That was the beginning of my speaking journey. And little did I know that I would spend 2 years doing different programs and learning how to be a professional speaker and learning the avenue, learning how to change the status quo. Prior to this, I tried different things. I didn't really have a structured strategy to affect change. But what I learned through the Speakers Institute was being able to be clear about my purpose, being clear about my message, and being clear about how to deliver that message to change the status quo for individuals and organizations. And that was a catalyst. That was the beginning of so many opportunities, like joining the Future Crunch team. It was the beginning of, it opened up opportunities for me in my business. I started my own business, and I have spoken on national and international stages, and I have worked with globally listed companies, not-for-profit organizations, and government departments to help them harness the gifts of diversity and inclusion. So these two moments, these two catalyst moments, were for me instrumental in finding my purpose and staying on course with my purpose.
And it's been such a joy to see you step into your power over the last few years. I've been privileged to be in that position. Now, Lillian, there's something else I want to talk about, because it's so easy to relate to diversity and inclusion within human groups. However, I think there's a much bigger conversation to be explored when we consider that maybe diversity today also includes emerging technologies like robotics or artificial intelligence. So how do we as humans learn to be in union with technology that has been designed to act like us?
The union of humans and technology, I think this is
it's a big one. It's a big one.
And this is something that I'm learning, and being part of Future Crunch has really helped with just deepening my knowledge in this area. I love that you've used the word union. I mean, we're in the fourth industrial revolution, and technology is not going anywhere. It's part of humanity now. So it's important that we recognize that there's a need to be in partnership with technology. And one of the ways that I believe that we can be in union with technology is changing the narrative. For a very long time, there's been this fear associated with technology, particularly around technology taking jobs, technology wiping out industries. But what I've come to learn, especially with the work that we do in Future Crunch, is that technology is actually not replacing jobs. It's actually replacing tasks within jobs, tasks that are historical, predictable, and tasks that have a low cost per error. And the first step, I believe, is actually understanding what the actual impact is, what the actual impact that technology has on us, on humanity. And also, the next step is also understanding the opportunities that technology presents. And this is part of changing the narrative. Technology has been used to advance, healthcare. It's been used to advance, even in COVID-19, it's played a powerful role I don't know whether you heard about, you probably read this in the good news stories at Future Crunch, share regularly, where this Israeli startup company created a AI tool that basically looked at over 2,000 case studies, research, medical research, and compiled the information and provided doctors with summary reports to help doctors quickly diagnose their patients and allow them to access treatment immediately during this COVID-19 season. So for me, technology plays a really powerful part. It plays a big part, and it is used in diversity and inclusion as well. Mm-hmm. There's so many opportunities that have come up as a result of AI. Organizations are now realizing that to create a more diverse and inclusive workforce is not easy. it is a big problem. It's a systematic issue. And those individual interventions, like, you know, having a coaching session here and there, mentoring, unconscious bias training, it's not enough. It's not enough to shift to move that needle. So a lot of organizations are turning to technology to enable them to create more diverse and inclusive workforces. And what they've found is this technology is used to actually disrupt bias that might exist in processes, that might hide in processes like recruitment. So, you know, you're recruiting someone, you read someone's resume, and you pick up, you know, you find a, you know, a word or some reference that, you know, that makes you, that drives a decision-making process, and you choose not to hire that person for that very reason, even without knowing that that's unconscious bias. That is what it's all about. Or, you know, bias that exists in promotion, or bias that exists in talent management. So technology is now being used to help decision makers, hiring managers, to pick up that bias quickly so that they can make different decisions that will allow them to create more diverse and inclusive workforces. So that is one way that we can actually be in union with technologies, changing the narrative, seeing what technology is and seeing how it actually serves us. The other part is also accepting and acknowledging that technology is not perfect. And after acknowledging is actually resolving those imperfections. That's really important. I believe that AI is powerful. It can offer lots of solutions for us and can actually solve a lot of the D&I problems, or diversity and inclusion problems. But technology is created by humans.
Well, that's the thing, because isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. It's created by humans. So that bias, whether it's conscious or unconscious, is passed on to the data sets that are used for technology, for example. And as a result, studies have found that it actually can perpetuate bias. Mm. So it's really important for businesses to be aware that you can't rely fully on the machine. You have to acknowledge that it has flaws, but our job is to recognize that and to be proactive in making sure that you test that technology before you deploy it. Make sure that when you deploy it, that you're constantly checking and making sure that technology is fit for purpose, and that the data that is also being used is constantly updated and represents the community and represents every group fairly. And if it stops serving you, then get rid of it. So I believe that we can be in union with technology if we are proactive as human beings, take our ownership and be proactive in managing the shortcomings of technology.
Yeah, it's about being so acutely conscious of how and why we're using it. I mean, it's making me think about something as obvious as Facebook, for example, that when we're in there and using Facebook and liking things, that we actually end up in this kind of digital echo chamber where diversity is all about being exposed to difference. So we even have to be, I guess, aware and conscious of that fact as we navigate the internet, to ensure that we're always, you know, open to new ideas and new ways of thinking, rather than just allowing the algorithms to feed us back more of the same.
That's right. That's right. There's a place for humans and there's a place for machines. Mm. I think when we recognize that, then it's about taking ownership and being empowered in the process.
Lillian, in coming back to the human conversation, I've heard you use the term intersectionality in some of our candid conversations. And that word was a real game changer for me in my understanding of what diversity was all about. And basically, it's a concept that explores the diversity found in one human being, and in many ways breaks down the labels around how we define difference. So, you know, the reality is you might be black and gay or even disabled as a random example. And that would be an example of intersectionality where you've got varying points of difference. How does intersectionality inform your approach to diversity and inclusion? How do you manage that?
So intersectionality is central to my approach, and all the services that I offer takes an intersectionality approach, whether it's coaching, whether it's consulting, delivering workshops or presentations. I use this approach because I have lived the intersectional experience and I truly understand the impact of certain aspects, certain diversity traits intersecting and creating privilege and also discrimination. Now, the term intersectionality is actually not used widely. A lot of people don't really know what it is. And it was a term that was coined by an American critical legal scholar. Her name is Kimberly Crenshaw. And she came up with this theory that when it came to gender inequality, gender inequality was different depending on what attribute or what aspect to your, you know, diversity trait intersected. So if you remember how I talked about the visible and invisible traits earlier on.
The iceberg example.
The iceberg, exactly. And the different things that form the invisible and invisible traits. So some of those traits intersect in a powerful way and actually create discrimination. So when you look at a black woman who is gay and disabled, the level of discrimination is compounded because of those aspects intersecting. When you look at a black woman who is educated from a high social economic status, her level of discrimination is different. These are two black women having two very different experiences. If you look at a white woman in Australia who is, you know, highly educated, top, you know, has a top leadership position, her experience is very different from a white woman who is disabled and is of a low socioeconomic status. So that is the theory behind intersectionality. Now, what is powerful about this framework is that those intersecting points can also lead to a privilege. There are times where certain things intersect in your attributes and you are privileged because of that. So if you're a white male that is straight, cisgender, you are one of the most privileged, if not the most, in the world. Compared to, let's say, a white male who is not educated and is disabled and potentially maybe very old. So when you look at all of those factors, those are two white males, but having two different experiences. One is most privileged and one is not. But what I love about this theory is not only the holistic nature, but it also recognizes the social context. When you move from one place to another, those intersecting points will mean something different. You could actually go from privilege to discrimination. I shared my story earlier. I came from, you know, Kenya being part of the majority group, not even realizing that I was black until I moved to this country. I never thought about my heritage. I came from a very well-off family and I was educated and all of this. So I had a lot of privilege in Kenya. And then when I moved here, my context completely changed and that privilege went. And here I'm just looked at as a woman of color or culturally diverse woman or black woman. And the challenges are completely different. So I love the holistic nature of intersectionality. But the issue that I have seen and the issue that a lot of organizations have is that they don't engage with it. they choose to look at maybe their staff members or their workforce experience as one thing, a singular thing. Yeah, they reduce the people's experience to just the labels. Exactly. So let's focus on the things that are visible. So gender or your sexual orientation, we're going to focus on these things instead of looking at the whole person. And as a result of that, a lot of people are being left behind. And if you think about women with disability, you think about the Indigenous women, culturally diverse women, older women, a lot of people are being left behind because organizations are not engaging with intersectionality. And there are gaps. And these are the gaps that United Nations have recognized. And they have a 2030 agenda to reach the furthest behind first. That's a statement of the agenda. To reach the furthest behind first. And this for me, this topic, I'm so passionate about this topic because for a long time I've tried to communicate my intersectional experiences. I've tried to share that with organizations to drive change, and that's been disregarded. And when I look at reports of gender progression, and we're doing really well, reports that are published by the Workplace Gender Equality Agency, for example, people talking about gender progression, I can't relate to that because my experience has not been factored in. And that is why I've joined with 8 other women to create a group called the Equitable Futures. So we're basically a group of people from diverse backgrounds, diverse experiences, and we're championing for change around intersectionality. Because we know that the current models are not working. We want every person to be included. And we've had discussions with executives of Workplace Gender Equality Agency and another powerful organization called Male Champions of Change, that is basically a group of CEOs from across Australia. And now our next step is to partner with top 10 Australian businesses and tech businesses as well to co-create equitable futures starting in 2020. Because we want everyone to be included. We don't want anyone to be left behind. So that is how intersectionality is so important in my business approach and in my life approach.
Yeah, beautiful. I'm actually reading a book at the moment, and it's an incredible book. You might have read it because it really does touch on intersectionality as a concept. And the book is by Sonia Renee Taylor, and it's called The Body Is Not an Apology. I'll share with you 2 quick quotes. The first one really sums up what you've just been talking about, where she says, "Our beliefs about bodies disproportionately impact those whose race, gender, sexual orientation, ability, and age deviate from our default notions. The further from the default, the greater the impact. We are all affected, but not equally." So, you know, it's right on point with what you were just talking about. But the second quote I want to share with you is that she says, "Body terrorism is a hideous tower whose primary support beam is the belief that there is a hierarchy of bodies. We uphold the system by internalizing this hierarchy and using it to situate our own value and worth in the world." So basically what she is saying there is that there is this unconscious hierarchy of bodies, which is determined by things like, you know, our size, the color of our skin, our ability, our gender, as a few examples. And that really to heal this, we have to get off the ladder, get off the hierarchy, and that's not something we can do through self-acceptance. Self-acceptance is kind of going, well, I accept that I'm, you know, on the bottom rung of this ladder, that it's not about self-acceptance, that it's actually about radical self-love. And that's the only way we can actually just jump off this social hierarchy altogether. So, you know, in reflecting on this idea of your body, your skin, and who you are, not being an apology, not being something you're sorry for, what does radical self-love look like to you?
That's a great question. That has evolved over years. Right now, radical self-love looks, what it looks like and feels like to me is living on purpose. This is the first time where I am fully doing what I love to do, where there's no boundary between work and my personal life. And this is not only being true to myself, but also true to the people that I serve. That is radical self-love, because for a very long time I have self-sacrificed, because I have internalized those hierarchies as you're talking about. Living for others, pleasing others, trying to fit into molds, succumbing to social conditioning. And a lot of the times I felt that there was this tension, this internal conflict, that something was not right. I was not being true to myself. So the journey that I have taken over the last 41 years has been about messing up, learning from those mistakes, discovering a little bit more about myself, and then just adding that knowledge over the years. And now I can say that I have a lot more clarity about who I am, what self-love feels like, the contributors of self-love, so of my relationships, my family, my work. And when I steer away from this radical self-love, I have this internal alarm that goes off. I'm reminded that I've stepped away. There's something. I'm not looking after myself. I'm not putting myself first. But this is a journey. But I have to say where I am now is the place where I can say there's more radical self-love compared to previous years.
Beautiful. And look, we've just decoded the unconscious social hierarchies and internalizing those social hierarchies. So I think within that, it's also important to address the unconscious self as an individual, the belief systems, the judgments, or the emotions that we're not conscious of. And in Jungian psychology, this is referred to as the shadow self, or, you know, in the world of science, confirmation bias might be another term that could be used. With that in mind, how do we become, in your opinion, more aware of our unconscious self, the belief systems, the judgments, or the feelings we have that might actually be contributing to the problem with regards to creating more diverse communities?
It starts with intention.
Yeah.
It starts with the intention of actually wanting to be more aware. A lot of people don't. Mm. And there's an impact. Part of the issues that we're facing, the social issues, for example, is because people are not conscious of what's happening around them. So it starts with intention and being aware, first of all. So being intentional about wanting to know your belief systems, your judgments, and even the unconscious bias.
And that, because that's the thing, you don't know what you don't know, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you don't know what you don't know until you're faced with a situation, and then you know that you did not know for a very long time. And then you have an opportunity then. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the example that comes to mind is a conversation that you and I had, just as a bit of a case study, because, I mean, I can tell you, I believe that I am a completely inclusive person with only love, light and harmony in the world with regards to nurturing a diverse and inclusive society. However, I remember at one point we were trying to schedule a meeting, and it was just after Black Lives Matter had happened. And I was kind of quite on point with you and businesslike in saying, all right, are you happy to talk about this? And obviously my intention was good in doing that. But I know for you, that was a bit of a catalyst where there was a level of not feeling that I fully understood your experience and the trauma attached
to experiencing something like Black Lives Matter. And I use that as an example because I think that that was an obvious point in time where I was clearly ignorant of your experience, not because I was a bad person, not because I wasn't somebody who valued diversity or inclusion, but because you don't know what you don't know. And my unconscious, you know, my unconscious shadow self played out there in that conversation. And I bring it up because I think it's important for people to understand that it's not about being bad. It's just there are things that we need to transform within ourselves to really facilitate a more diverse world and more inclusive world.
Mm.
And it starts with these little conversations.
Oh, I love that case study. And it was a very difficult time for me because I was going through this whole process of understanding or just being reminded. It's almost, people say it's like PTSD. So I talked about intergenerational trauma. And I didn't quite understand how much the George Floyd's death had impacted me. So I was going through all of that. And then we had that conversation about having the interview. And even though I understood your intention, and this is what we spoke about, it was the impact. It was how it landed. The timing was not right. And I just felt that my feelings were not considered. And we had a conversation about it. A lot of people do not have these conversations. A lot of people choose to avoid these conversations. And that's one of the many issues that we have when it comes to racism in this country. It's a very uncomfortable conversation. I don't know about you, Bex, but I was very uncomfortable throughout that conversation.
Yeah, I think my point in bringing it up in this podcast is to kind of put compassion on the table with both sides, because it's very,
absolutely,
you know, because I don't think, like, I'm just going to use a label here and go, like, white people don't mean to be bad. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not, none of these issues are because people are bad. It's because people don't understand, and that I think there needs to be compassion on all sides for us to eventually come into the union required to create a 100% inclusive society. That there needs to be, yes, an acknowledgement of pain, but an understanding of how we've got here and what needs to shift.
Absolutely. I agree. Compassion needs to be extended always. But at the same time, they also has to be, the context also needs to be appreciated as well, both ways. And I'll read out a quote that hopefully gives you some context on why it is important to hear each other out. Because for me, I know that when I speak out, my experiences are rationalized. People water down my experience, they brush it off, and the reason for that, they probably, some of them talk about it being very uncomfortable for them, so they choose to do that. So at the end of the day, you end up feeling like you're not understood. The people choose to justify and use references and statements to justify their positions. And you probably heard these terms before: white fragility. It's not about attacking a particular race, but there's also black fragility as well. You know, for me, it's really about being heard and being understood. And I felt that it didn't happen initially. And that's why we had that conversation. I'll read this quote from Bain & Company, the managing director, so the global managing director. And he said that it was just in light of Black Lives Matter. He said, we must all listen more, not seek to rationalize through our own experiences, but rather through the lens of those who hurt and frightened for themselves and their families. Now, the reason why I bring this up is what I felt happened after we had that conversation, when we addressed the issue, is that there was a mutual need to understand each other, to understand the context. I was not going to have a conversation with you, Bex, if it was about being defensive, if it was not about being right and being wrong. I was not going to take that approach. My intention of having that conversation with you was to make sure that I engaged and informed you of the personal impact, your intention had an impact, and to also learn from you how you were affected, because you were also impacted by my words. And that conversation, we're able to have that for about an hour, and I felt that we came out the other side because there was a deeper understanding of each other's experience and an agreement to do better. It's not about being right all the time. This is not about that. It's about us being able to feel confident enough to have these conversations and do better next time.
Yeah, look, I think I think the lesson in this from my perspective is helping the audience, those listening out there, to understand that there is a level of difficulty in navigating the complexity of these issues, because, as I said before, people don't know what they don't know. But that there are tools, which is what you're talking about now, with regards to how we open up the conversation, how we allow in more compassion, more empathy from every angle in order to move closer to a point of integration
exactly.
And to lead from the heart with these issues, whether that be in corporate workplaces, whether that be within our communities or within the world at large.
I totally agree. And one of the things that has actually come out of Black Lives Matter and also our conversation, Bex, I've gone into a partnership with two other women. Her name is Chantel Thompson. She's an Indigenous lady. And the other one is Gemma Saunders. She's a British lady who identifies as queer. Mm-hmm. So we have this collective, and we are actually talking about the same issue. We have created a program to help people have brave, vulnerable, and these vital conversations around race, equity, and inclusion. And it's about creating a psychologically safe space to have those difficult conversations where you move people from that fear zone where it's, oh, this is too uncomfortable, I can't talk about this, I'm going to avoid this, I'm just going to deny the problem, I'm going to defend my position, to a place of learning where you're asking questions, where you understand your privilege and discrimination, where you understand how to listen to others. And to get them to a place ultimately in the growth zone where you're able to sit in your discomfort, where you're able to also educate other peers and share your lessons through some of the mistakes or the victories that you've had along the way, where you're able to be honest and vulnerable and say, look, I didn't know that. I didn't understand that. And I made this ignorant decision. So this program is designed for that purpose, to really help people to build their confidence, to have these conversations. And we're going to use storytelling. We're not going to pump our audience with technical terms. We're going to use storytelling to inform people about bias, things around discrimination, prejudice, and how to have those conversations with others and how to seek to understand. So we have our first session with a company called Enet. So they're a travel company that have a digital platform. It's a tech company. And we'll be running the program with this global organization. So we have a session with Australian staff members towards the end of November and the UK office as well, because people need this. People need to know how to do this.
This is the bridge. Like, it's one thing to talk about diversity and inclusion, but if we're not willing to walk into the fire in order to really be able to transform the issue, then we're not able to heal it. So I think this work is incredible that you're talking about at the moment.
Yes, and we're passionate about this. There are not too many spaces where people can actually be themselves and feel safe and do that in an organizational context.
Yeah. So, Lillian, I've actually come to the last little segment in the podcast, and it's a relatively new segment that I'm calling Shots of Purpose. So basically, Shots of Purpose is a little fireside chat where I'm going to roll through five questions, which you can answer either in like one word or a few sentences, but we'll move through fairly quickly. They're designed to explore purpose in the present moment. So I'm going to start you off. You ready to go?
I'm ready. Let's do this.
All right. Name one emotion that feels like purpose.
Fulfillment.
Love that. What recently moved you so much that you either welled with emotion or shed a tear?
The death of George Floyd.
Name a book or a podcast that rewired your thinking and tell me why.
Podcast. So Super Soul Sundays with Oprah.
love her.
Yes. And she was interviewing Deepak Chopra, and amazing spiritual leader. And he said something that really moved me. He said that, I've got this here. In your personal transformation is the future transformation in the world. No social transformation happens in the absence of personal transformation.
I love that. So if you could see through the eyes of any animal, which one would you pick and why?
Lion. I would pick lion because, I mean, they call it the king of the jungle, but I want to see what it looks like and what it means to be powerful and how to use that power to help others. That is what I would, I'll choose the lion for that reason.
Beautiful. Well, the world is certainly hearing you roar. Now, as the final one, I often chat to my guests after the podcast and they're always like, oh, I wish I'd said that. So with that in mind, is there anything significant over the course of this podcast that you have left unsaid that you should say now?
Yes, we talk about diversity and inclusion. And for me, the thing that I think there needs to be a shift in people's involvement. For a long time, this work has been done by, sometimes with people with bleeding hearts or the victims of discrimination, or HR. It's usually the responsibility of change is usually assigned to a small group of people when diversity and inclusion affects all of us. We can be beneficiaries or we can all be impacted if we don't have a more diverse and inclusive workforce. So what the message that I would like to share with others is, let's step up. Let's look at diversity and inclusion as an opportunity for humanity. And let's adopt that Harambe spirit where each person plays an active role and collectively we can actually change our humanity. Collectively, we can change things, not only for us, but for the next generations. But it requires each person to step up and play their part with whatever they have, not waiting for the stars to align, waiting for that big paycheck, that house, that move. No, with whatever you have right now to play your part. And you can do that by asking questions. You can do that by reaching out to somebody that you've never, a different kind of person that you've never engaged with, and inquire and build meaningful relationships. You can do this by calling out bad behavior. You can do this by educating yourself. You can do this by sharing information, storytelling. There's so many ways you can contribute. So my call to action, my encouragement to every person is ask the question, what can I do to help? And then what do I have within my power? And how can I use this to drive change in diversity and inclusion to benefit me and the people around me and the next generations.
What a beautiful way to end the podcast. This has been such a truly rich and wonderful conversation to have with you today. Thank you so much. And for our listeners out there, where can they learn more about your work?
Thank you, Bex. So you can find more information on my website. So that's www.lilliankikuvi.com. And all my contact details are there, as well as my social media platform details as well.
Lillian Kikuvi, such a pleasure to have you on the Decoding Purpose podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bex. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast. If you have enjoyed the podcast, please take a moment to leave us a review. That would be greatly appreciated. And we'd also love you to join the Purpose Movement at Instagram by following us at Decoding Purpose Podcast. Also, a big shout out to our sponsors at Supernova Sound.